This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
This episode of Retronauts is brought to you by Uncommon Goods.
This week in Retronauts, Past Masters and Gold Masters. Hello, welcome to Retronauts. I am Stuart Gipp, and I am completely, terrifyingly, hauntedly alone at the moment. It's kind of weird having no one to banter with but myself, and I suppose you, the fine listeners of the Retronauts podcast. But I won't waste your time, not today, because this is a bit different, this episode. It's a couple of interviews that I did regarding a couple of, I guess what you could term beat-em-up games, hence the thematic connection. I spoke to Chris Kohler at Digital Eclipse about the making of Karateka, which is the first in their series of sort of interactive documentaries that they're making. The next one should be revealed by the time this episode drops, or if not, then shortly after. So I'm looking forward to that. I also spoke to Raymond Teo, who was the founder of the development team that worked on Double Dragon Gaiden, which is a really rather enjoyable beat-em-up game, in fact. Now, Double Dragon Gaiden is, I'm not going to lie, so we're a little bit behind, the topicality with that one, because it came out a while ago. But I'm hoping that this interview might prompt a few more people to take sort of interest in it, because it is good. And I haven't seen a huge amount of talk about it, which is a shame, because it does deliver, I think. Fans should definitely get their head around it, because there's more there going on than you'd expect. It's good fun. But you'll hear that in the interview anyway. So for now, I'll stop this preamble, and we'll just head straight into the first of the interviews. Hello, I'm here with Chris Kohler of Digital Eclipse. Did I pronounce that correctly all the way through?
Yes, everything. Chris Kohler, and then Digital Eclipse, yeah.
I think I said Kohler a bit too much like Coca-Cola, and now I'm worried that there's going to be some legal problems. But no, it should be okay. And why we're here, because Digital Eclipse recently put out something that I would do not think it's exaggeration to describe as groundbreaking. You know, in terms of how retro gaming is presented in digital media, because the way retro gaming is presented and how compilations are done and how re-releases are done has long been a thorn in my side and my foot and my head, eyes, anything, all the unmentionables, thorns, just, it's gross. You don't even want to.
Thorns everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere that one could imagine a thorn and nowhere where one would pleasantly want one. But the point is, that's all irrelevant, because we're talking about the making of Karateka. I'm going to pronounce it Karateka the whole way through, even if that's wrong. I'm reasonably sure that's wrong, I'm still going to do it, because I've just been, you know, when you grow up saying it one way.
Oh yeah.
You can never change it, like calling.
No, exactly.
Ryu, like calling Ryu Ryu. I'm not even sure.
We all say, you know, Karateka at the Digital Eclipse office. Then it turns out everybody at Broderbund, Jordan included, said Karateka. So if you said Karateka, you should just keep saying that.
I should. Okay, that's good. Yeah, because right now I want to get into this, because the making of Karateka is the first installment in. It's, actually, why don't you tell us what it is? Because I think that would be better coming from
you. Want me to do it? Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Making of Karateka is a is an entry in a new genre of video game that we are attempting to pioneer at Digital Clips called the interactive documentary. It is very much like if you played Atari 50, the anniversary celebration. The idea is we are bringing back classic games with the respect that they deserve and the context that you need to really understand. And not just have a game ROM in front of you running on a modern platform, but to understand like how that game was made, who made it, when was it made, and why was it made, so you can fully appreciate the history around it. And so this is the first in what we're calling the Gold Master series, which is going to be a series of interactive documentaries bringing back classic, essentially focusing on some interesting story of video game history, whether that story is the story of one game, the story of one person, the story of like a genre of games, the story of, one publisher or one developer, or anything in between. And so Making of Karateka is not, it is a re-release of the classic 1984 game Karateka by Jordan Mechner, who was the creator of Prince of Persia. It really is a documentary story about the making of Karateka, with the games, they're in there, they're fully playable, but we're not saying like we're just selling you these games again. We're selling you a story that even if you have never heard of Karateka, even if you have no nostalgic attachment to it and you don't necessarily want to, play it again, This is a story that should be interesting to you and might even make you a fan of Karateka if you weren't before.
Yeah, so absolutely. Because coming from my personal experience, I have never played Karateka until now. I knew it existed because I've read Jordan. I mean, I know about old games a bit. I've read Jordan Mechner's Prince of Persia Diary, in which it's mentioned many, many times, of course. But I hadn't really sat down and played it because it wasn't, I didn't have a system that had it on, or I didn't have it on the system, on the Spectrum, which would have been, I guess, the only place I could play it. But,
right. And even if you had played the Spectrum version, you wouldn't really understand the appeal of Karateka.
The Spectrum version of most games is really just a facsimile. It's just like someone wrote the idea of the game down on a napkin and just said, here you go to town. Now, though, coming from Atari 50, which is, of course, it's that sort of philosophy applied to the entire history of Atari, I got to ask, where is the gem for doing this for a single game? Where's the very beginning of this? I'm curious. Was it around before Atari 50, or is it something that came up as a result of Atari 50?
Oh. It was around before I joined the company in 2020, when they revived the Digital Eclipse brand back in 2015. Mike Micah, our president, I mean, he knew Jordan well, and they really, he was a big Karateka fan from back in the day. And actually, so was Tom Russo, our director of business development. They were just huge. It's like a formational game for them. And they knew that it hadn't been brought back, and they knew that Jordan personally owned the rights to Karateka. So it was something we could negotiate directly with him. There didn't need to be a publisher involved in any way. And so essentially they identified Karateka as a great opportunity to go in and do an independent, it was essentially like supposed to be a smaller independent release done in between these big projects that Digital Eclipse was getting, because Digital Eclipse was doing, of course, big games for Capcom and, Blizzard and Konami. Right. And so basically this was the sort of a downtime project where, we could work on this, between projects. And so when I came in 2020, there was already a version of it that had been done by, mostly by people that had since left. It had the interactive documentary kind of vibe to it, but it was more like if you imagine like, kind of rudimentary, kind of like non, edited like film clips that were then interspersed with interactive elements, but it was really kind of told in a linear way. And there might be something to that. There might be something we can do later on down the line with that concept, but like basically it was that, and then there was more of a traditional retro collection kind of vibe applied to it where you could play the versions. There was a museum, a lot of the content was sort of organized by category rather than in a narrative way. And this project was basically handed to me, and I decided to go all the way back to the beginning. Read through all of Jordan's journals and, redo the research and look at all of the stuff that, you know, that people had looked at. And it kind of occurred to me that, like, oh, there's just such a wealth of material here, because Jordan Mechner, when he was a teenager, he was a teenage college student at Yale University when he made Karateka. He, in a very kind of like, in a way that nobody else really did at that time, you know, game developers or otherwise, he kept a daily journal and he wrote down everything he did that day. And you could see all of his emotions and frustrations with not only Karateka, but the other games that he was working on. And not only that, but I mean, everything was dated. And so, you know, kind of realizing, oh my gosh, like, we can take this journal and we can take these scanned documents, because of course he did all his design documents on paper, saved every single one of them, donated them all to the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York. So those are all preserved.
Yeah.
We had scans of all of them. And then we also had Jordan's floppy disks, which Jason Scott and Tony Diaz, people from the Internet Archive, had 10 years ago now, had dumped and preserved all of the data on those disks. And we had access to all of that. So between the early stuff on Jordan's floppy disks and the design documents and the journals, you know, it's like we could tell a chronological narrative story. And so really taking inspiration from, you know, the way that museums set up a narrative sort of exhibit, we tried to, you know, put together kind of totally redesigned the way the user interacted with the items and built out brand new timelines and stuff like that, that would incorporate everything and tell it in a sort of a narrative way. Again, kind of taking inspiration from the, you know, sometimes you go to a museum and there's like a pair of headphones and you put it on and you're listening to like an audio exhibit. I thought, gee, I've got my friend Kirk Hamilton, who does this amazing podcast called Strong Songs, in which he, you know, he's a musician and a podcast host, really talented multi-instrumentalist and music theory guy. And he breaks down the music theory behind pop songs, and Karateka soundtrack was so strong that was created by Jordan's father, Francis Mechner, who was a classical pianist. He brought in leitmotif,
it's heavily featured in the videos as well, which I thought was quite poignant, honestly. It was quite fascinating, but sorry to interrupt you.
Not at all. So we had this, we had this extensive, you know, video of home video, basically, of Jordan and Francis Mechner sitting at the piano in his father's apartment in New York City, where Francis Mechner had composed the music, and Jordan had sat next to him with an Apple II, like programming, you know, the music that he composed. And, you know, Francis Mechner as a classical pianist really brought a sense of, well, we got to have leitmotif for these characters because there's not much we can really do with the Apple II. So if we're restricted to these very short melodies, then we do it as a leitmotif approach. And that helps you with your storytelling, you know, and it's like the music was really composed to accentuate the storytelling of the game in a way that really nobody else was doing in 1984. Mm-hmm. And so we had all this. So Kirk did a 15-minute audio podcast, which I think he did it back in like 2021 or maybe even like early 2020. I mean, you know, I was working really hard on this in 2020 and it had to keep getting shelved because we just had this parade of major projects coming in that we had to work on. There was even a point where we were going to bring it back at the beginning of 2022. And we had meetings and stuff like that for like, oh, how are we going to get Karateka to the finish line? And then we signed Atari 50, the anniversary celebration. That had to get done in 2022 for the 50th anniversary year. So shelved again. But then, you know, fortunately, we were able to, with all the learnings that we had from Atari 50, because Atari 50 basically, and so getting back to the question that you asked, with Atari 50, since we had already been doing all this work on the interactive documentary, The Making of Karateka, and, you know, sketching out like how that was all going to work as a documentary first type production with the interactive timelines and stuff like that, we were able to pitch to Atari, and Atari was looking for something. Atari needed something that wasn't a collection because they already had collections of their game. They already had Atari Flashback, Atari Vault. This already existed. They needed something that was actually different. And so, you know, that's why they came to us and we were able to pitch, look, you know, we're going to do this documentary story about the history of Atari and the games are going to be integrated into that. And so, again, just getting to the point where when you press start on the Atari 50 title screen, it doesn't jump you into a menu that says games and museum and options and stuff like that. It literally, you press start and it goes into the timelines and it's very clear to the user, like, this is the key user experience here. You get to start going through and looking at these timelines. And, you know, it's a gamified sort of thing where it's like, here's your progress. You got this node, you got that node. But that was it was a risk, but it was really important to us to, you know, really finally try to do this project that we've been thinking about for a long time of like, you know, centering that museum, that timeline, that historical experience front and center. But, you know, and the thing that I was really, you know, passionate about was just doing it as a chronological narrative, you know, to take the player through the story. And then with Ben, then we were able to take a lot of those learnings that we had through doing Atari 50, finishing Atari 50, because, you know, it's one thing to start something and it's quite another to take it all the way to the finish line. And you learn a lot doing that. And then we were able to visit that back onto all those learnings back onto, you know, the Gold Master series, with Karateka being the first game for that. And so that's kind of, it all kind of took place simultaneously. It was neither before, Atari 50 was neither before nor really after truly making Karateka.
By the time you hear this ad, Cyber Monday will be partway over, and that means you're running low on time to figure out what the heck you're buying for those last few weirdos on your holiday shopping list. You know, the one whose personal interests are shrouded in mystery, or the ones who respond to your every gift idea fishing expedition with a mumble and a half-hearted shrug. The good news is that even with time running out on the holiday clock, you still have time to find a perfect gift for even the most cryptic recipient on your shopping list, thanks to Uncommon Goods. Their enormous array of offerings runs the gamut from classic to eclectic, just like your friends and family. My guy, who doesn't seem to have any worldly interests outside of his afternoon bubble tea, he's getting a DIY boba kit from Uncommon Goods. The cousin-in-law, whose daily hydration routine involves switching from coffee to wine sometime around mid-afternoon, I'm going to save her a step by giving her a packet of Merlot-infused coffee beans. Shopping at Uncommon Goods doesn't just benefit the folks on your holiday list, it also supports artists and small businesses, many of whom make their products by hand. That's why you can be sure that everything you order from Uncommon Goods will be as high quality as they are unique. Whether you're buying apparel, jewelry, food, tools for the office, or even virtual lessons and other experiences. And for every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, $1 goes toward a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $2.5 million to date. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/retro. That's uncommongoods.com/RETRO for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
It seems to me like the sort of natural, I mean, I'm not going to say conclusion because that implies that you're done, but it seems to be like going from, say, I'm going to go right back here to like the Mega Man Legacy Collection, where the sort of the main draw is all this high res artwork that's never been seen in this high res before. You've never been able to look at it in this detail, like not even the art books are that detailed. And moving from that to, I mean, there's a lot in between, but I feel like the catalyst, or not the catalyst, I don't know if it was in development at the same time or what, but the museum in the Aladdin and Lion King collection feels like a formative version of this in a way, because it is more like showing you, it's more linear, it's more of a kind of, each page of it is more exploratory and more explanatory. I mean, of course, there's not as much material to work with for whatever reason, but it does feel like with the making of Karateka, it's brought that to the forefront over, as you said, over the actual, I hate to say over the games, but it just centers the whole experience. You know what I'm trying to say? It's very hard to get
I mean, it does decenter the games. And I think that's important, especially when, like, taking a, you know, really a realistic assessment of the games themselves and saying, does, you know, can these games in, you know, 2023, can they stand on their own and sell this product? And I think that it's like, look, there have been Atari game collections since the Super Nintendo, you know, Super Nintendo had, like, you know, emulated collections of Atari games. And so, and at that time, I think about a lot of people, because again, at that point, those Atari games were barely 20 years old at that point. Some of them weren't deep. You know, we have games from the, you know, if you had an Atari collection in the 90s, you know, Atari was still making 2600 games in the 90s, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that meant that there were lots of people who were just waiting for the chance to play those games again. But today, with Atari 50, I think you're going out there to an audience of people who maybe they've never played any of these games. And so you can't rely on their pre-built-in nostalgic attachment to them. But the thing is, it's still worth playing them. And so a thing that I tend to find is that I think that the behavior of a lot of people when they get a classic collection of like 100 Atari games, something like that, is they jump in and they play these games for like a few minutes each. Oh, and so a lot of the question is, how do we harness that behavior and turn it into something that feels like a larger connected experience? Because like when I get like an Atari collection and I jump, it's like, you know, you jump in, you play some Asteroids, like, oh, right, yep, that's Asteroids. Then it's like, oh, let me look for another game. Oh, Food Fight, that's interesting. I'll play that. Okay, yeah, interesting. And then after an hour of just like messing around with these games, you can start to feel like maybe this product is not for me. Like, I'm not finding anything that's grabbing me. And so if we can take those games, decenter that from the experience, put the focus on the journey, the historical story that you're going through, as if you were watching a film documentary, and then use the games as artifacts, well, then it's okay if you are maybe only playing that game for a little bit, because it's all adding up to something, you know, from Pong on one end to Tempest 2000 on the other end. And so the fact that Atari 50 then came out and people kind of got what we were kind of trying to get at with it is very good, because it gave us the confidence to say, well, we can do this with Karateka, which is literally an interactive documentary about a single game. And it's like, Karateka, you don't even play the retail version of Karateka itself until the end of the third of five timelines. Yeah. So you spend, if you're going through this linearly, which again, you don't have to do, it's a video game, you know, you can go wherever you want. And it's just, and in that sense, it is just like a museum, because, you know, a museum can lay things out in a narrative way and they can use artifacts to tell a story, but they can't force you to look at things in a linear way, right? And you need to have that control, and you need to have that control when you're sat in front of a TV and you've got a video game controller in your hands. You must have that. You must feel that controller. You're going to get frustrated. But and what we found, though, is that people do want to go through in a linear way at their own pace, but like they have no issue. It's like by the time they finally get to the game, this was all built around. They've got so much more context, and it's, you know, they're so much more interested and emotionally kind of invested that when they finally do play it, it connects with them so much more.
And I've got to ask, because I will come back to the sort of the whole philosophy behind compilations, because that's what interests me the most. How old games are presented. But talking more about the making of Karateka specifically, could you tell us about Karateka Remastered and the other new projects, the other new games that are in here, or the other new game that's in here, I should say?
The ones that we did, or the ones that are unreleased, or just everything?
Well, everything, really. But I'm thinking mostly of Karateka, the remastered Karateka, and Death Bounce 2000.
All told, there's 14 different games in this package, even though we're saying it's really about one game. And so we were able to, you know, get permission from our friends at Atari, and we were really appreciative of this, that they had no problem with us publishing the clones of Asteroids that Jordan made when he was 16, Asteroid Blaster and Star Blaster. Then we published four different prototypes of Death Bounce, which was a shooting game, a arcade style shooter for the Apple II, and that was what Jordan was doing before Karateka. That got rejected also. That's never been published before. There's multiple prototypes of Karateka leading up to, you know, the retail versions. There's three retail versions, Apple II, which was Jordan's original, and the Commodore 64 and Atari 800 versions, which are what was, those were made at Broderbund kind of under the supervision of Jordan. So those are considered to be like the good versions as well. And then we've also got Karateka Remastered and Death Bounce Rebounded. Karateka Remastered is a new version of Karateka done by Digital Eclipse's president, Mike Mica. It's smoother and faster and has upgraded graphics and sounds, but still retains, you know, the core of what made the original fun. And then also there's a commentary track that Mike put throughout that in which he discusses essentially the behind the scenes of how he made it. He discusses, you know, his research into Jordan's original game. And so that kind of like accentuates the narrative and the story that we're trying to tell as well. And then finally you have Death Bounce Rebounded, which was done by Jeremy Williams and Dave Reese, who are two amazing game designers that we have here at Digital Eclipse. Jeremy did Vector Sector in Atari 50, the anniversary celebration.
That was so cool.
Yes. And Dave worked on Haunted Houses and Sword Quest Airworld. And also so, cool. Yes. And so they actually did Death Bounce Rebounded. That was actually basically finished before we started on Atari 50. And so that was the first game that they did in the Eclipse engine, in our Eternal engine. They have made this wonderful twin stick shooter that, again, is based on Jordan's original. They looked at the journals and they looked at the original game and they tried to, you know, take inspiration and direction, you know, essentially from young Jordan, from his journal entries. So when they integrated new enemies into Death Bounce Rebounded, they were doing it based on ideas that Jordan had, you know, and obviously it's not, you know, it's not a one-to-one sort of thing based on his design documents, but it's, you know, it's essentially as grounded in the history as they could make it. And Death Bounce Rebounded is sort of serves as the, it's like, Jordan was never able to publish Death Bounce. And now we have this great version of it that really shows like, that his original ideas were very interesting, and it's almost from like a parallel universe in which Death Bounce did get published and it was a big hit, and then there were all kinds of sequels to Death Bounce, and then this is the 2023 version. You know, there was probably like a really ill-considered move into like, you know, polygonal 3D for Death Bounce on the N64, and then they pulled back, and then there was probably like Xbox Arcade Death Bounce, you know,
bringing back Death Bounce. So I'm surprised, but I think this is growing up from the old like microcomputer perspective again. But when I played Death Bounce, the original, or one of the originals in the making of Karateka, I was pretty much like, no, to be honest, this is pretty sick. I quite like this. Like, this is quite fun. So I'm a little bit surprised it wasn't published, but then again, I wasn't too familiar with the Apple II sort of scene or standard.
Oh, so Death Bounce was really good, and it was a perfectly serviceable game.
I mean, I saw the correspondence, obviously, it goes into this, which I read as part of the compilation, as part of the collection, but it still fascinates me because it seems like such a fun game that it's a surprise that it didn't get picked up.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, well, that's interesting because I think that Jordan really, really wanted to get this published by Broderbund in particular. He really had a love for what Broderbund was doing, and he seemed to be hyper focused on getting something published through Broderbund in particular. And so he could have, I think, taken Death Bounce to some other publisher and gotten it published. And quite frankly, you know, Broderbund, they could have published it too. It was fine. It was more than fine. It was very good. But it just shows you that at Broderbund at the time, they were very worried about becoming stagnant. And they, I think, saw, and I think this really, really is down to a lot of the influence of Gene Portwood and Lauren Elliott, you know, Gene Portwood in particular, the ex-Disney animator that they had hired, who, like, he wasn't a game designer, you know, he wasn't a programmer, but he was like, he was a wonderful animator, and he was really pushing to like, we have to make video games that have this human element, that have people, that have stories, because, you know, I think he was looking and he was not really seeing a whole lot of that. And like, he was really feeling like video games were a storytelling and animation and narrative medium. And so you know, he was, and he influenced games like Choplifter by Dan Gorlin, you know, to get those, the characters and the story elements. And then that ends up, you know, kind of influencing Jordan as well. And then Gene Portwood, as you know, and Lauren Elliott end up then coming, you know, working on Karateka when it comes into Broderbund. Essentially, it's like, you know, Death Bounce was a good game, but it was a good game from 6 months ago. And Broderbund saw the writing on the wall as like, the games that are going to be popular now and a year from now are going to be more story and character and narrative based. And so that was, you know, again, they could have just taken it and published it. But instead, I think they, well, first they really tried hard to get Jordan to do essentially a new version that incorporated the character and the animation. And then, you know, it just didn't work out. Like Jordan was essentially chasing something that had already been a success. And what he really needed to do was he needed to try to figure out what was going to be a success a year or 2 years into the future. And so that's why we make that point, you know, in the documentary that like the rejection of Death Bounce was really what inspired the creation of Karateka.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was, I mean, the whole thing is fascinating to me, but I really did enjoy that stretch because it's so rare that you get the insight into the sort of that much, the sort of rejection process or the public that attempting to get onto a publisher. All of the correspondence just I thought was fascinating how kind of nurturing it was, you know, because they obviously saw something there. Something I want to ask. I want to ask something that's sort of a bit broader about Digital Eclipse, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. Out of curiosity, really, I'm just interested in how sort of development works there. And obviously, you can be vague about this because I'm not going to try and sneak any details out of you. Yeah. But I'm curious, at sort of one time, how many projects are generally sort of being worked on? If you can answer that in vague terms, that's if necessary.
Sometimes a lot, you know, sometimes again, it's like, well, there's multiple loose sort of teams of people. And obviously those teams will shift around, you know, based on what kind of thing is going on. Like right now, without revealing anything, I know that there's, you know, there's like 1, 2, 3, 4, and I hope I'm not forgetting anybody, you know, there's like 4 like projects that are in like active development. And so there might even be 5. So yeah, it's like there's usually a lot kind of going on and there's a lot of crossover and stuff like that. I mean, as editorial director, I'm across all of the, you know, historical research and writing and stuff like that. And I have a team now. It's me and Dan Amrick, who, you know, former Ubisoft guy, former GamePro editor from back in the day. And so, you know, between the two of us, it's like, you know, we're on everything, you know, from whatever the editorial needs of that project are. And then of course, you know, across, you know, working with the publishing team on all of our comms and stuff like that, because again, we're like, we're a small developer. So I'm like, I'm writing the email newsletters and things like that as well. So it's a very unique position to be in because basically it's like, you know, that at any time there's multiple things going on.
Now, I think this is sort of a shorter answer, but do remind me, because my mind has gone blank. Is there anything currently announced that we know about? I don't think there is there? Because I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
No, I mean, the other thing I should mention is Wizardry, Proving Ground.
Yes, of course. I knew there was something. The Wizardry remake, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a full 3D remake of the first game in the Wizardry series.
Yes.
It's available now in early access on Steam and GOG.com. And again, it is early access, so I mean, you know, there expecting there's going to be bugs, but yeah.
Yes, I knew that was something. I feel so foolish now. That's like built over the Apple II version, isn't it? Like, that's crazy. Yeah. That's insane. I mean,
So basically, like, you know, again, like really adopting the, you know, making sure we're adopting the Digital Eclipse ethos, even when it's something where it's a remake, you know, of a classic game. Like, there's no editorial component to this project at this time. Like, it's entirely possible that, like, you know, later on down the line, you know, we can add stuff like that. We would love to add stuff like that if it becomes possible.
I mean, it must be a harder game to research than many of the others. And this has not been available for a long, long time, right? Like, in English.
We have a general sense of the story, and you know, it would be something we would really like to do. But you know, at this time, the project is a straightforward 3D remake. But the point that I want to get at is, even though it's a 3D remake, again, it's being approached with that commitment to the historical accuracy. And so, essentially, the way that they started was they took the source code, which is written in Pascal, and they ported it to Unreal Engine. So
it's literally a port
of the original code, so making sure that everything under the hood is working the exact same way. But also then of course you can bring up the way the Apple II version would have rendered on the screen as well as an option. And so everything is just being done with that level of commitment. Yeah.
See, I'm kind of fanboying now, but it just reminds me, because I'm laughing, because I'm not incredulous, but I'm just kind of in awe of how crazy that is to port Pascal to Unreal. Like, that seems crazy. Surely that has that been done before? It seems like it hasn't.
If somebody's done that before, I'd love to hear about it.
But it makes me think back to the Blizzard collection, where I remember saying, in fact, I think I said it on Retronauts pre-release, my pipe dream would be that they put the the Mega Drive levels into the sort of the SNES controls, into the SNES engine. There's no way they would do that. It's too much work. And then it comes out, and what do you know? And of course, then my pipe dream is that Lost Vikings 2 is going to be in it, but it looks like it's not. Oh, now it is. Okay.
That was
a crazy month for me.
There were a lot of things that you said or that you wrote about, and it's like, it's funny because you just have this like gift of prophecy where you'll say something, and it's like, I know that it's actually coming. Yeah.
Yeah. The Retronauts kind of, I don't know if it's a curse, but we have a habit of doing a subject and then at the end lamenting that it's finished now, or there's not any more, or that there's not any sort of follow-up to this. And then after we sort of log off and go on Twitter, it's been announced.
Immediately happened,
probably like 20 or more times. Yep. I'm hoping that we'll do a Guitar Man episode at some point, fingers crossed. Okay. So, I've got to ask some questions that I'm reasonably sure you can't answer, but I'm going to ask them anyway. And we can cut them if it's just like the blood. But okay, the first thing, coming through Making of Karateka, as fantastic as it is, and it is fantastic, my mind obviously goes to Prince of Persia because it's, you know, the thing after it. Now, I'm assuming that that's an unbelievable amount of red tape and probably not on the cards, but I've got to ask, like, is there any hope for the making of Prince of Persia? Because that would be peak. That would be peak.
I mean, we would love to do it.
Because I think about that, and I think about like the idea of getting like the Apple II version, getting like the SNES version even in there. And Mega CD. I mean, there's so many versions of that game.
People look at Karateka, and it's like, well, what other game could you possibly do this for? It's like, what other game is as well documented as Karateka was? And the answer is none of them, except for Prince of Persia, Persia 2, and then like The Last Express. Basically, it's like, you know, it's just because Jordan kept up that journal the whole entire time. And and has all the, you know, the strong has everything. So it's like, you're absolutely right that it represents a greater challenge, and it may never happen. But I mean, I can certainly say, like, we would absolutely love to do that.
I think as a sort of a pipe dream thing again, is there anything in particular you personally would absolutely love to do with as part of this Gold Masters?
Well, okay. I mean, I'm assuming that Shigeru Miyamoto is listening to the podcast right now, so please return my calls. I've been calling every day, and you just hang up. I'd love to talk about doing this with Super Mario Brothers.
You know what? Now that you mention it, I think I asked you this last time, and you said that. And so I apologize for. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's the answer has not changed.
Well, I mean, Nintendo's in touch with their history. I mean, we've got that remake of Mario versus Donkey Kong coming out. Like, well, you know.
So So here's the thing.
GBA 7 out of 10, Mario Vista.
Even if Nintendo does not call me personally, I would hope that, you know, and not just for Nintendo, but for everybody, I would hope that us getting stuff like the making of Karateka out there and the reception that it's gotten, people are saying this is great. You know, this is a really great way to present gaming history. I want to see more of this. Will inspire people, other developers, other publishers, when they are going back to the well, when they're looking at bringing out, you know, re-releasing legacy games, that think about maybe doing it in this way and think that, you know, there's actually, we can actually show that there is demand, you know, for something like this.
Well, I mean, there's a new 2D Prince of Persia coming out. Get some eyes on the history. I don't know. Just saying.
Yeah,
Ubisoft, if you're listening, stop being terrible.
I think it's wonderful that, you know, that a new Prince of Persia is coming out. People are very excited about it. I mean,
Do you know is Jordan still involved in Prince of Persia, or is it just more of a sort of consultancy sort of, or just sort of a in name only sort of thing?
Well, he originally moved to France because he was going to do a Prince of Persia game with Ubisoft that ended up getting canceled.
And
then he's not working on this version. But you know, it would essentially be, you know, yeah. I mean, it would be up to Ubisoft basically, and up to him. If they wanted to like involve him in it.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm asking too many Prince of Persia questions.
It's a natural thing to bring up, and all I can say is, you know, it would be wonderful.
I'm sure you can't tell me what they are, but do you have more Gold Masters in development at the moment?
Yep.
Cool.
So it'll be, it should be, the Gold Master series number 2 should be out this year.
Oh, hell yeah. So is there any inclination of when we're going to find out what that is?
Basically, like, the behind the scenes is we're still trying to figure out like what is the best, you know, way to announce what it is we're doing. Yeah.
So. Right now on Retronauts, give me the scoop.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Best way to do it. For sure. Yeah, that's not going to happen, is it? Okay. Nope. I tried. It's the canceled Savage Dragon game for the Super Nintendo. No, it's
yes.
not.
There was an attempt.
I'll tell you what I want to see the most. This sort of ties in with something I think you were talking about on Twitter the other day, actually. The history of gaming is not just good games. It's not just the classics. And I would love to see something like Acclaim, like Bart versus the goddamn Space Mutants, you know? One of the most messiest games ever. And I love it, and it fascinates me. And I would love to know what was going on with that and all that stuff and those LJN games and those all, you know. So a Gold Master series, because I know that, I think it was on the subject of Limited Run putting out Plumbers Don't Wear Ties as this big lavish kind of edition, which is fantastic. But I'd love to see a Gold Masters on something that wasn't so well received, you know, or something with a complex story behind it as to why maybe it turned out the way it did. I mean, I think stuff like Rise of the Robots, you know, one of the most disliked games of all time, I would buy that day one if that was what the hell was going on behind the scenes for that one. But I mean, what do you think about sort of gaming history as it pertains to maybe the lesser games, so to speak?
Right. Well, I think that if all we're doing is we're looking at like what games are, you know, extremely popular and, you know, what and therefore could sort of carry a release by themselves as the stars of the show, then people are just going to gravitate towards games that were reviewed well at the time, you know, that are, or the franchise is still really, you know, really well known. But if we're looking at things from the perspective of the interactive documentary, that changes the calculus, because then you can bring back bad games. You know, you can bring back games that were poorly reviewed because the experience that you are offering to the player can actually be a good, fulfilling, fun experience, because you are offering them the interactive story of how that game got that way in the first place, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, that's ultimately the benefit here is that the star of the show is the documentary, is the story. And so it really does, it allows us to bring things back. And even you can see little bits of this with like Atari 50, because like Club Drive for the Atari Jaguar is in there. I mean, that was a game that was very poorly reviewed even at the time and has not aged well, but as an early, very, very early polygonal, you know, racing game with a first, you know, a first person perspective, but a behind the car kind of perspective, it's like, it's really interesting to jump in and mess around with it and play it, because we're not, it's when the expectation is not that we're selling you this game and you're going to have a certain kind of fun with it. The expectation is that it's in there, you know, to show the history of Atari, and it's it, and it, it becomes fun to mess around with it and see how janky it is, you know,
I mean,
when the expectations are set appropriately.
I think that goes back to what we said at the beginning, really. It brings us full circle very, very, very conveniently, actually. It makes me look like a genius. When we've had retro compilations, and I'm not calling Making of Karateka a retro compilation, because, you know, that's a small part of it, of the experience, but say, like, I think back to, say, the Mega Drive collections or the sort of the Genesis collections that Sega bring out seemingly every generation now, with all the same games every time. And you get 50 or so games in there with absolutely nothing, nothing in the way of historical context. You can't even look at the box art. So you'll boot something up and you'll play it for a few minutes, like you say, and then with no context, you'll die. You'll not think it's fair. You won't really know what you're doing. And you just drop it. And, of course, to bring it back around, what you've done there with Club Drive even is by giving it the context of, you know, the problematic sort of system that it was on and everything about it. It doesn't matter if you don't want to play it. It's just, it's part of this thing. You're walking around with your headphones on and you're being told why this thing matters. And then if you want to, you can interact with it. And that's fantastic, and I wish that all compilations had that. I mean, you know, with something like the Cowabunga collection, of course, that's another pipe dream collection of games there, where the addition of sort of, you know, annotated art, context, you know, trailer, commercials even, just puts everything into some kind of perspective. It's not on the same level, but it's clear that that effort is there in everything you're putting out.
If you look at, you know, previous collections, as you, I think you've kind of referred to, it's like you can see us, you know, getting closer and closer to the interactive documentary form, you know, doing what we can in the space that we're provided in those products. And so, you know, with Blizzard Arcade Collection, it was like, you know, there's a Blizzard history section, which has photographs, but then it's not just a bunch of photographs out of order. The photographs are in chronological order as best we could, and then if you read all the captions through the photographs, there's a narrative being told there, right? And it's trying to we're trying to put down, like, not just like chronological bits of trivia, but like trying to have a beginning, middle, end type narrative. You know, that kind of shows, you know, who are our main characters, what are their struggles, you know, when do they fail, when do they succeed, what is the lesson you can take from all of this, you know. So you kind of see that there with Cowabunga Collection. You know, we weren't able to do the sort of narrative history. We were able to reproduce the design documents, and it turns out that there were like literally thousands of pages of them. And so because we are crazy, we were like, well, we're just going to put all of them in there, aren't we? And we're gonna actually localize all of them, so you have the floating English text or whatever language you want over the documents themselves, so you can just sit there for hours and just read how these games were designed. And it works for Turtles because that is an example of something where everything is baked in already. Everybody loves the Ninja Turtles. These games were incredibly well received. These games sold millions and millions of copies. Like, they were some of the best-selling games of the era, you know, and the franchise itself is more popular now than it ever has been. So it's the perfect, you know, people are going to rip that game off the shelves. You don't have to like convince them to play these games. And so, but again, you know, the more you look at things, the closer and closer you're seeing us get. You know, we always want to try something new. What is the new thing we're trying, you know, in this game? Actually, one of the things that I loved in Cowabunga Collection was the, you know, we did the interview interactive strategy guide.
Oh, that was so cool.
And thank you. And that was something that I would love to bring back at some point, because I think we really kind of nailed it as far as like this, that was a really cool feature that people enjoyed. So I hope that, you know, maybe there'll be something in the future where we can bring that back.
The general Turtles vibes from that whole package was just great. I mean, it was, you know, we were blessed with that and with Shredder's Revenge around the similar sort of time. Yep. It was a wonderful time for Turtles. Now, I think that brings me to a point of sort of naturally winding up. So I'm very grateful for your time, and thank you. I'm finding out what the next game in the series is following Making of Karateka is now my newest goal in my life. Like, this is now my new obsession, and I'm... And you know what? The only one I'm going to find out is when it gets announced. So hurry up and announce it, please. And I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be able to get it out for you any other way. So I'll keep my ears to the ground and absolutely fascinated by what this could be. Because, I mean, Karateka, like a formative game, classic game for sure. Wouldn't say it was a household name, though, for this generation especially. So it's a very interesting one to have started with. And of course, when I heard it, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That makes sense.
You know, again, I've been on Retronauts since I think 2006. You know, and one of the things
way
that
longer
I think,
than me.
You know, especially the early versions. You know, the earliest. You know, Retronauts is that it was very sort of very console centric and very America centric. As you know, that of course just sort of grew out of like, you know, who was hosting it at the time. Mm. And the thing is, and you know what I think people have come to realize is the problem with a lot of those. You know. Early podcasts and early books about video games, things like that, is that this sort of narrative got entrenched that, you know, the story of video games is first there was Atari, right?
Yeah.
And then Atari crashed. And then for 2 years, nothing happened that are of any note whatsoever. And then Nintendo came riding in on a white horse in 1985 and saved video games.
Well, as listeners now have had tediously beaten into them by me.
Yes.
That ain't the case for us in the UK. No,
it's not the case anywhere but America, and it's not the case for computers. And so Karateka is one of those stories that doesn't get told very often because it came out in 1984. And like 1984, but video games were dead. What are you talking about? And it's not true. And the thing is, if you don't tell these stories, then they get forgotten. And the, you know, history kind of gets written by the winners, even though Karateka was a... It sold very well when it came out. It made Jordan a whole bunch of money. It was extremely influential. Like, it is not in any way, an overstatement rather to say that Karateka like inspired a generation of game designers. And that's something that we get into when we talk to guys like Tom Hall, the co-founder of id Software. We talk to John Tobias, the co-creator of Mortal Kombat, about how influential Karateka specifically was on them to get them in, and then how influential it was on the products that they would make later. And so we have to make sure these stories get told because they will get forgotten. And it's like, yeah, you're right. Like, a lot of people hadn't heard of Karateka, and that's bad. Like, they should know about this game.
I think that, and I'm not going to get extensively into it, but I think that retro gaming, particularly when it comes to, say, the sort of online forums and YouTube, is extremely limited in it, how it's presented. So I strongly agree. I mean, the popularity of sort of certain channels and Let's Plays, which exclusively focus on US and Japanese games and openly mock European or UK games whenever they are sort of showcased, fascinates me to a degree, because it's this whole thing of like, well, I mean, I played this when I was a kid. I'm pretty sure it wasn't the Stockholm Syndrome that made me like it. Because I wouldn't play it if it sucked. But stuff just gets dismissed out of hand, and it bums me out. So, I think what I'm saying is that the next game in the series needs to be Manic Miner. So I'd like, if you can make that happen, you'll have to track down the developer who's a known recluse. So good luck with that. thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to the next one and whatever else is coming from Digital Eclipse, because you know I'm an avowed fanboy, and I will gush over everything.
You should. You will like the next one. You will absolutely like the next one.
I'm so hyped.
will not have to wait too long to play it either, so just give us a little bit. Yep.
Aero the Acrobat is coming. Okay. But no, thank you again, Chris. I'm sure we'll talk soon again.
All right. Yes. Yeah, thanks, dude. Definitely.
But thank you for coming on. I'm really grateful. And all the best with whatever you're working on right now.
Thank you.
Cheers. For the second part of our episode, I'm going to be speaking to the founder of Secret Base, the development team of Double Dragon Guide and Rise of the Dragons. Would you like to introduce yourself to the Retronauts listeners?
Hi, everyone. I'm Raymond from Secret Base, and I'm the founder of Secret Base. I am the guy that does the design work, the artwork, production stuff, all that except the programming. So hopefully I can answer some interesting questions today.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, it's nice to have you and have you here. I've played the game for, I think, a couple of weeks-ish now prior to this. I've been enjoying myself a good deal. And I've got some questions I want to ask about it. But I think the best place to start would be just kind of, I guess the real obvious question is, this is a Arc System Works, is that right? They're the current owners of Double Dragon. So I'd like to know how this came about, or sort of how you got your hands on this in the first place, if you can tell me.
Well, this start of the whole thing happens a while back. So in 2014, I released a beat 'em up. So this was a parody zombie beat 'em up that I released on Steam, you know. And yeah. I think Arc System was at the time was looking at maybe publishing indie titles, you know. So they reached out to me and we discussed, but that didn't pan out because I was already, you know, working with another publisher and so on, you know. Yeah. But we had a good chat. A couple of years later, when I'm looking at making another new game, at this point I look at it again and I realize that they have actually acquired the Double Dragon IP. And in fact, they just released Double Dragon 4. So Double Dragon 4 took the game in a very classic, the approach was very much an extension of the classic titles on NES especially. So, so I thought that was interesting. And maybe, you know, since they have just done that, maybe they will be interested to try, you know, putting the game on a different direction. So I tried to get in touch again, and pitch my idea for how I would handle the IP. But of course, it's not like I give them a call and then like we are on board, right? So it took some convincing, you know, especially for a small developer like myself. So we shared the game, and then I think it took quite a few months or close to a year before they finally gave us the go ahead. So I think that was quite interesting in the sense that like they would give an indie developer a chance to do something like this.
Yeah. So sorry, did you produce like a sort of a prototype or like a demo or was it just a design document kind of thing?
I can't quite remember the sequence now, but there was definitely at some point a high level document about how the game would work, and then I also made a mock up video. So at that point, I already showcased like, you know, the general art direction, and I believe even then the tech team mechanic that is one of the highlight for the game is already something that we have put in as early as that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So, and the previous beat 'em up, that was Streets of Red. Is that right?
Ah, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I was looking, doing sort of research prior to this, and I saw, if I pronounce this wrong, I apologize, but Toby's Vertical Adventure. Oh. And I was at this kind of moment of just like, Oh, wow. Because I haven't thought about that one for a long time, because it was one of the earlier Steam indie games that I played. But I did enjoy that as well. So that was
That
was
nice. You played that?
Yeah, a long time ago. Long time ago. Yes. Must have been over a decade. But I remember because it was... This almost sounds backhanded, but it's not supposed to. It was almost at a time when a game that looked like a sort of 16-bit-ish game was still of huge novelty. Or it was still very fresh. And I'm not saying it's not still good, because I love pixel games, but there are a lot more of them now than there were then, obviously. So that, I just thought I'd mention that, because it's still a good game, Toby's Vertical Adventure. So, no, yeah.
Thanks.
Now, I should ask, because the beat-em-up sort of genre, or belt scroll, or whatever you want to call it, because it's gone through sort of a semi-renaissance that's lasted quite a while now, but it's kind of... You had things like Scott Pilgrim and then Streets of Rage 4, much like way after that, and more recently, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came back. So it was, how do you feel like Double Dragon kind of sort of fit into that? Did you take any sort of inspiration from any of the more contemporary games, or was it all drawn from the original series?
I wouldn't say, well, put it this way, when I started pitching, that's when a lot of the high-level ideas were formed, right?
Yeah.
This new wave of what you call the beat-em-up renaissance has not yet started.
Yeah. No, okay.
So I didn't know that River City Girls 1 was coming out.
Okay.
So that was quite a while back. Yeah. So it was only as I work along, and in fact, like a lot of the things already pretty much nailed down, that I start to see all these news and new games coming out.
Yeah.
So as a fan, you know, like that's great. As a developer, it's very hard for me to shift gear and take inspiration, you know, from that point onwards. So, yeah. So that's that. And about the inspiration for the game, how much do I look at these new games compared to the classic titles? I believe that was the question, right?
Yeah. Because I mean, from my perspective, there is stuff here that draws all the way back to like the coin ops, the arcade game Double Dragon. But there is an infusion of sort of more modern gaming and modern sort of, it's not a term I like using because some people immediately are drawn away from, but the sort of roguelite-y stuff, which I don't think personally is especially roguelite-y. It's more just in the tradition of arcade, but this is not, you know, I'm not going to sit here and give you all my opinions here. It's a good thing for me because, like, as a recent example, between stages, when you sort of level up your character, when you unlock new perks for the characters that you then spend your sort of cash on, was that something that was in place sort of early on, or did that come around later? I'm just kind of curious.
I had the idea pretty early on. It's a matter of how we would go around doing it. But knowing that I want the players to have some upgrades that they can purchase, that's, like I say, you know, very early on, a lot of these designs were already in the pitch that I proposed, yeah.
Yeah.
So to share a little bit about what you mentioned just now, like the roguelike thing. So I agree with you, and this is something that I try to highlight when we talk about the topic, is that for me, like, this is a beat 'em up first and foremost, you know.
Yeah.
With a tin of roguelike elements that sort of help the replayability. And in fact, the way I approach the roguelike elements is not that I try to make these the dead cell of Double Dragon or anything like that. It was more of like, hey, let's look at the roguelike mechanics. What are some of the things that can help us? You know, and from very, very early on, even in my previous game, the parody beat-em-up Streets of Rage that I mentioned. So even then, the mechanic I was already looking at, you know, like beat-em-up is an arcade game. And when you were at the arcade, actually the number of tokens or credits, depending on where you are, that you use to revive, like how much money you had that day is pretty much how much continues you have for the game, right? So
there's
a sense of tension playing the game, and then like, oh, I really don't want to die, because if I do, then I have to pay more, you know? So that's a bit of that. And then like, I was very much looking at using roguelike to see how I can utilize or push that feeling even more in a way that you're no longer using your real money, but in-game currency. But it evokes the same emotions, you see.
Yeah, so what I liked personally a lot was when the game was originally sort of trailed, I thought that looks good, but I was worried that it would be like Scott Pilgrim, which is a game I like, don't get me wrong, but I'm not a fan of the thing where you spend money and your character just gets better. And then when you go back and replay the game, your character is just better. That's, I don't know, I'm not a fan of that. And in this game, it didn't do that. It was that you could spend your money on sort of tips and advice that you wanted, or new characters to play as, or you could use it in your in-game, in your run. But it wasn't that you were just making the character permanently stronger. It was still your skill, ultimately, that was getting you through the game, which is great, because it means, in theory, you could come to this game on your first run and you could clear it. I don't expect it would happen because it's not an easy game, but it could happen. And that to me is all important. So that's what I enjoy. That's something I enjoyed about this game, especially, is that it's doing something that does complement the genre with those elements. And the sort of the token system, where you can either sort of use your money to continue or turn it in by unlock new things. It's like, it's a player's choice. You know, it's not a matter of, you will not be able to do this unless you lose. Does that, you know what I mean? That's something I like a lot. Another thing I liked was the sort of special meter system and how you're juggling that with your tag teams. Nice. Could you tell us about that, please, or how that sort of came about and how that's implemented?
What about it? Do you want me to share?
Well, it's interesting because I've not seen anything like specifically like that before, and the way that it's tied to your healing and also to your tagging out, but you can't always do it. There's a nice sort of juggle there. It's quite rare that you don't have special, but when you don't have it is always when you really need it. So it creates a nice kind of bonus. It creates a nice kind of, what's the word, sort of risk reward. Because like, if you whiff a special attack, then you can put yourself in big trouble. But what it sort of encourages you to do, of course, is throw yourself into the fray, because of, you know, when you're taking down more than one enemy, three or more enemies, you're getting health back, or you're getting money if you have full health at that time. So I'm just curious where that sort of, where that came from, if that was just a completely, it's not something I can recall seeing before.
Well, for a start, again, you know, like when I previously worked on Streets of Rage, some of this mechanic, you know, were already in their early stage. Right. So that was great because I get to release a game and I try a version, and then we do play tests, and then when it got released, players give us more feedback. So that was already brewing in the background before this even started. So and I do always like what you mentioned, right? The balancing between the risk and reward, and that is in many different parts of my games, you know. So when it comes to the special, one of the things that get thrown in this time around is actually the tag team mechanic. So I think what makes it interesting is also because, like, so I was looking at the tag team mechanic and how I should do this, right? And the obvious thing to do is, hey, let's look at tag team fighters. So games like Dragon Ball FighterZ, Marvel versus Capcom, you know, and there's already a lot of interesting mechanic over there that I know can work in a beat 'em up settings. So we tried doing that. And then for a long time, the problem was how do we make it work with the special move? You could have made it separate where the tagging is the tagging and the special move is the special move. But I knew pretty early on that I want them to use the same system, and you sort of have to balance between it. But it took quite some tries. We actually did quite a few iterations. I think we played quite some time with this mechanic until we finally get one that we feel like that really makes the player decide, or rather like have to think about, do I want to use my special move, or do I want to keep it so that I can tag and protect myself? Or do I want to use my special move and then tag my buddy out to continue the combo, you know? And I think that eventually clicks well. Yeah. That was another thing about how the move actually, when you use the special move, the frequency of how much you can use the special move.
Yes.
We started the game with a lot of that. So you, at first you can do it almost endlessly. There is no bar management. We tried that. And then eventually we tried one where you have to, every time you use it, you have to wait for maybe 5 seconds or make it really hard for you to earn getting the move back. You know, so we tried various extreme, but eventually we realized that, you know, having a move is actually more fun for the players because the action can continue. You don't have to lose your momentum, and it actually pushes the players to try harder and experiment different things.
Yeah. I found with what something I enjoyed was the fact that the tagging can be used as really sort of effective defense as well, in that if you're caught in a combo, for example, you can tag out and break the combo, but then it puts you at the cost of not being able to immediately sort of retaliate, which I quite liked. I found it was one of those games where you can survive a long time, even if you aren't yet necessarily good. But it's a matter of getting to the end, obviously. Now that's sort of a much sort of taller order. Now it did make me wonder, with the way that the game sort of adds segments to the stages depending on which order you play them in.
Mm-hmm.
How challenging is it to test that sort of a system? Because it seems like there's a lot of permutations of different levels there.
Testing them is always a challenge. So, because you have to go through different routes, and you have to play the different routes. You have to play them with different characters, you know, and these are the things that's going to make the player happy. You know, they're going to enjoy having the different routes. They're going to enjoy going through the different routes with different characters. But for us, from the testing perspective, then that's like multiplies the amount of works that needs to go into it, right? So luckily we did quite rigorous testing. I used to teach in a local university, so I at some point I brought my game back and conducted some play testing over there.
Yeah.
But that was never enough, you know. Like we did, I think, a couple of sessions, you know. But that was not enough, and then eventually we have to with Modus on board towards the end of the project. They got in a lot more QA to help us with that. But yes, it's true. It's like it was a nightmare to try to do things like this, which is why I think in roguelike games, like full-fledged roguelikes, they often have to put the game in early access so that they get players to give them feedback and run through the game repeatedly for them.
Yeah. And the difficulty sort of tuning is when it's a roguelike that does require iterative kind of progress, that must be, I guess, less challenging. But because this is one that is skill based from start to finish, then obviously it needs to be tuned very well. I thought it was. I mean, when I've done multiple runs, I've tried the different stages in different orders, and by making them sort of longer and more difficult, it's more organic than just kind of shuffling them. You know, I think it works well. I mean, I will ask as well, you might have covered this already, but I'm curious if how Arc System Works were particularly hands-on with this, or whether they let you sort of get on with it, so to speak. Mm. I mean, obviously you were pitching and back and forth, but once you were in development, were they sort of checking on it, or were they letting you kind of make the game you wanted to make?
Yeah, they were actually very, they are not very hands-on. Like, what's the word I'm looking for? But basically, they let me try. You know?
Yeah.
So they are not very restrictive. The only thing that they are a little bit more careful about is things to do with the law, the IP, you know, to make sure that we will not bring this game in a direction that they don't want how the how the brand to look, you know. So obviously that's important, right?
Yeah, I mean, being Double Dragon Gaiden, that, you know, it's another story, a side story. So that should give you some leeway to sort of do as you please.
But that came in later.
Right.
So when we first pitched the game, the idea was that we were either going to make this a sequel, which is Double Dragon 5, or we're going to make this Double Dragon 0.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I think I'll delve into it a little bit, since I think this is an interesting topic.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So we wanted to do either a sequel or a prequel, which to me, as a developer, that's super, super interesting, right? Because how many people get the works on a mainline title? But at the same time, I knew early on that I want this Double Dragon to have a bit of everything from the previous games. So we want all the characters to come back. We want to use some of the music from the previous games and all that kind of stuff. And we just couldn't quite get it to come together, you know, because the lore would always be fighting against us. You know, like some of the characters are a little bit too similar. Their motivation is like they share the same motivation, or some timeline, a character would supposedly already have died. Why would they be here now? So we couldn't quite align that. But the conclusion was that, in fact, it was proposed by Arc System Work that, you know, instead of making this Double Dragon 0 or Double Dragon 5, which makes things very rigid for us, why don't we do it as Double Dragon Gaiden? And then that sort of like release us from the lore a little bit. We can play around with it a lot more. So that was very nice.
Yeah, so do you have any, this is a frivolous sort of question, but did you have any particular favorite sort of characters you wanted to get in there as playable? Because it's quite a large roster. I don't really want to spoil all of it because some of them are locked, but I mean, obviously, Marion being front-loaded because she's mostly known from the previous games for getting punched in the stomach and, or killed. And now she's out there doing stuff, which is, you know, great. This is what we wanted. But do you have any other particular favorite characters that you wanted to get in there?
Our favorite characters that I want to get in, but I couldn't.
That too I'm curious about, but more just what you have in there, who you enjoy sort of playing as, or who do you think has the particularly interesting kind of moveset? Because everyone that I've tried has felt very different, which is nice.
Yeah, well, for the characters, I think I managed to get all the characters that I thought was important to be in the game. You know, for a while, I almost couldn't because of the timeline and everything. But in the end, I think like all the characters, you know, that people can immediately associate with is already in there. There are some popular characters that I already see a lot of people in the comment section asking about them, you know, like we obviously couldn't get every single character in, right?
Yeah.
Especially given how different we made the characters. A lot of work were put into them. So there are still some characters that I hope that I can eventually bring in. I wouldn't say any names because I feel like that is something that maybe in the DLC is something that we want to approach. Yeah. But there is quite a few that are, in fact, we did some artwork or we already brainstormed on how they are supposed to work. We just couldn't quite fit into the timeline.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. I mean, I think that if the people who play this game, I don't think they should be in any way let down by the character selection. There's a plenty of playable characters there, but anything more that gets added obviously would be a great great to have. As far as sort of Double Dragon adjacent characters go, the one that springs to mind that I want, I know is impossible and it makes me sad, and that would still be Skullmageddon, but that's the Double Dragon Neo thing, and I think that's a River City thing because they've kind of crossed over Kunio-kun and Double Dragon in that respect, but I guess it remains to be seen. I did enjoy sort of the sense of humor in this game, like the elevator music in the first stage and such. Is that something that you wanted to get in there?
Yes, a little bit, but I wouldn't want, and I guess we never really wanted to push it too far into the sense where it becomes a parody of the franchise itself.
Yeah, and that sort of has happened with Neon, in a sense, because as much as I enjoyed Neon, it was maybe slightly less well received overall, and I think there was an aspect of that I saw. But
So I think like that's one of the direction that they try, right? And also because they tried that, it's sort of like I wouldn't go too far into that, you know. So this time around, I always enjoy having humor in my games. But this time around, I have it still because that's just in my DNA. But at the same time, I try to skew it back a little bit so that the general tone of the game can remain the way it is. And also my programming partner that worked with me, Shen Yu, he also released other games in the past, like the Rocket Bird series. I think you might have played it before at some point. He also has a good sense of humor, and actually the elevator music that you were talking about was his idea. He was and he showed me, and I was having a good laugh about it. And then
I mean, it's a very brief scene. It's not that I wanted to characterize it as a, you know, parody like you say, but I just thought it was a funny sort of acute sort of sequence to have. In there. I thought it's interesting how I think the different stages and their sort of different feel sort of come together, because the first stage I don't know why I said that, because you can play them in any order, but the building stage where you can sort of explore sort of the side rooms and eventually make your way up to the top, that was interesting. But it's less of a sort of exploration game and more sort of linear sort of belt scroller. So I wonder if that was something that you intended from the off, because or was there ever a point when it was more sort of free roaming at all?
Well, yes, actually. So we experiment with this as well. So early on, we look at, so one of the things that we look at Double Dragon, well, one of the things that we did was look at Double Dragon and analyze what is different about Double Dragon compared to some of the other beat 'em up, right? And especially for Double Dragon, I think the terrain was actually something that is above and beyond compared to games like, I love those games, Final Fight, Streets of Rage.
Yeah, yeah.
But those features more linear level with a giant piece of artwork as the background and you walk from left to right fighting enemies.
Yeah.
Double Dragon have you jumping up and down, especially on the NES.
Yeah, platforming, climbing ladders and things, yeah.
But we were looking at that, and we were looking at this game and see what we can do about it. So our environment system is pretty robust. In fact, we could have done even more, which we tried early on. But after some experimentation, one thing was the scale of the game to include exploration on top of the idea that we already have. That is quite a bit. Second thing is a player might get lost. You know? So it's sort of, because it's so explorative, they sort of don't know where to go next, you know, and you then get into this problem where, hey, I buy a beat 'em up because I want to de-stress, I want to fight people and have fun. But then now I'm all of a sudden in this building that I cannot get out of, you know. So in the end, we sort of streamlined the experience a little bit so that the player always know where to go. In fact, one of the things that we did, the level that you mentioned, the one with the big building.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you realize, but that entire building is actually one continuous environment that you can keep going.
Right. Yeah. It does create that sort of, the fact that the different screens are sort of delineated doesn't detract from that. It does feel very cohesive, I think. But it's interesting because, what it gave me is when, because I did that level first, the first time I tried the game, I was thinking, oh, River City, like this is a River City style Double Dragon thing. But then, no, what it ends up feeling like to me is like almost a sort of homage to that, but not that. It's very much Double Dragon, which is nice because River City already exists. So, you know, they have blurred the lines a little bit, but it is a separate thing. I will ask then, which of the sort of older Double Dragon games did you want to sort of get in here? Because it really is a more diverse series than it seems like, with the different NES games, not to mention the arcade games. There's even a crossover with Battletoads in there. I don't suppose there's any chance of the Battletoads turning up at some point, is there?
I mean, that is really a question for Microsoft and Rare, right?
Yeah, okay.
I would love to work with them.
Yeah.
Hopefully, after the game is out, you know, like if it does well, yeah, that might be something that we can open a topic and discuss with them. Like I would love to make it happen.
Yeah, yeah.
But going back to your question, I think you were talking about the previous games. If I'm not wrong, you were trying to ask if, like, which were some of my inspiration or something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, of the original games, like which elements did you want to bring forward the most and iterate on?
Comparatively, I think I took a little bit more from the NES games than the arcade games. Mm. A big part of that was because, Double Dragon actually was one of the few beat them up that when they bring it over to the home console, they actually redesign so much of the game to make sure that it works well from a home experience. So that was looking at the difference. It allows me to peek into the original development team's mind about what they see that might attract the players and all that. So there was some thoughts put into that to make sure that this is a game that you play at home, right? So and also because of my personal preference about as a gamer back then.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but aside from that, you know, like the home console actually have a lot of very interesting stuff. Oh, sorry, the NES version actually have a lot of very interesting stuff. For example, how Double Dragon 3 especially had some ideas where you actually have characters that join you halfway through. You know, Double Dragon 2 had a lot of platforming section and things like that. So we look at a lot of those, each one of them, and try to see like, hey, can we take at least something from each one? You know, and also, although we didn't take any direct reference from, but we try to also study the things like the cartoon, the movies, and there was a fighting game that is based on the movie, which I really enjoyed. I mean, the fighting was pretty well done there. And I played that game quite a bit back in the days. So I also try to look for those for inspiration. You know, the movies, although a lot of people say that it's so bad that it's good, but I think there is really some genuine good ideas in there.
Yeah.
Double Dragon, the original Double Dragon, if I recall correctly, was inspired by The Warriors. I feel like the movie feels a little bit like The Warriors for kids.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I eventually try to work on is to bring in that element of gang and gang identity from the Warriors. You know, so that is eventually what you mentioned. You know, like how we try to separate the different gangs and give them some different identity, so that when you visit different location, you have a different experience.
Yeah, I love the interstitial screen when you beat a boss or a gang boss that you then see the other gangs get stronger, like the visuals change. I think that's a cool sort of an idea. I don't have a huge amount sort of left to ask. I will say the game's launch. When is the game launching again, please?
The game launches on 27 July.
And that's on like lots of different systems. That's on PC, PS5, PS4. Etc. Switch.
Yes, it will be on all the major console and Steam as well.
Yeah, I've been playing just so that people know, I've been playing it on Switch and on Steam, and they're for me they seem to have parity. Like they seem to be exactly as good. So nothing to worry about there for Switch players. I've had lots of fun with it, so I'm looking forward to when it launches, so I can gush about it slightly more freely. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about the game with me, and hopefully the launch goes really well, so that we can have Battletoads and other reasons, but not just that.
Well, yes, thanks a lot for having me today. Like, it was a lot of fun hearing what you have to say about the game after playing it. You know, like we made this game over the COVID period, so a lot of it wasn't until much later where a lot of things were already, you know, said and done that we can start to share with people. And at this point is where we really start to share the game with more players and reviewers and, you know, everybody, right? So it's really nice to hear what people think about the game, especially after having their hands on the game. So thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for all this.
No problem at all. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Yes, the voice you've been hearing this whole time, you're now hearing again. Stuart Gyp, that's me. I swear I'm not trying to get myself over here. I keep saying my own name like it matters, but what I'm really here to do is to wrap things up in the customary manner, in a calm and collected way. If you like Retronauts and you'd like to support the show, first of all, thank you. Second of all, for a mere $5, you can get not only 2 extra bonus episodes a month that are completely exclusive, but you'll also get all the regular weekly episodes a week early. So, you know, you're going to be just a super switched on, cool guy who knows exactly what's going on with Retronauts as soon as it comes up on the pleb feed, which, you know, the free feed, is why I call it the pleb feed, because, you know, plebs. They'll be like, oh my god, did you hear that episode about Karateka and Double Dragon Gaiden? And you'll be looking at your sort of manicured fingernails and you'll be like, yeah, last week, you know, kind of moved on, kind of over that now. But not only that, you'll get Diamond Fight's tremendous This Week in Retro columns, not just in written form but also in speaking form, because they like to make podcasts out of them, mini podcasts, and they're very good, very, very well produced. You'll love them. You'll also be able to go on the Discord and say swear words to me, and there's nothing I can do about it. You can call me a bald twat, and I can't do anything about it, nor can I really disagree with you. So, thanks very much for listening, and we'll no doubt speak again soon on Retronauts about retro games. Thank you. I'm not good at ending podcasts. Bye!
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling Yuzu Mango IQ Mix Hydration Mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition. Great mission. Go to iqbar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all iqbar products plus free shipping. That's iqbar.com, promo code KELLER20.